Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. I'm Scott Harris. This week we present Mel Goodman, a senior fellow at the Center for International Policy and a former CIA analyst who assesses the motivation, conduct, and consequences of Donald Trump's lawless and chaotic war on Iran. Branko Marchitich, a staff writer with Jacobin magazine, who examines Israel's role in fomenting the disastrous and escalating U.S. war against Iran. And Katherine Hines, founder of the Connecticut Visibility Brigade, who talks about her victory for free speech in the dismissal of criminal and civil charges for engaging in highway overpass protests against the Trump regime's authoritarian policies. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
As U.S. President Donald Trump and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu prosecute a war of aggression against Iran, the aftermath of an earlier regime change war continues to destabilize the oil-rich nation of Libya. Saif al-Islam Gaddafi, the son of Libya's longtime ruler, Muammar Gaddafi, was murdered in early February. At his well-attended funeral, many supporters wore green, the color of the old Gaddafi regime, which was ousted by the U.S. and NATO in 2011. A brutal civil war has gripped Libya ever since. Libya's opinion polls suggest that Saif was the country's most popular public figure. For many, he embodied nostalgia for a time when Libya was united, its state apparatus was working, and the nation's welfare system intact. Today, predatory militias roam the desert, two rival governments squabble, and public services decay. Saif's calls for elections resonated with millions weary of the warlords and kleptocrats who have pillaged what ought to be Africa's richest country. That some mourn a man indicted by the International Criminal Court for crimes against humanity speaks less to his virtues than to the bleakness of post-2011 Libya. In early January, Indian police raided the home of prominent environmental activists over charges that their advocacy for a treaty to cut the use of fossil fuels was undermining India's national energy security. Investigators from India's Enforcement Directorate claimed that Harjeet Singh and his wife Jyoti Avasthi, co-founders of the group Nature Forever, were paid more than $660,000 to support the Fossil Fuel Non-Proliferation Treaty. The initiative is an international campaign calling for a treaty to stop future exploration for new fossil fuels and to gradually phase out their use. First endorsed by the Pacific Island nations of Vanuatu and Tuvalu, the proposal has the support of 17 national governments, the World Health Organization, and the European Parliament, as well as a large number of civil society climate activists. Under authoritarian President Narendra Modi, India's civil society organizations have faced harassment and repression. Almost 17,000 licenses to receive foreign funding have been suspended, and a large number of these groups have been forced to shut down. For decades, America's corn crop has dominated the nation's agriculture. Corn, grown on 90 million acres in the U.S. heartland, is used to feed livestock and is a main ingredient in processed foods. Over the past two decades, corn-derived ethanol has been blended into American gasoline, but it comes at a steep price. Barn Raiser Media reports that research finds that the nitrogen fertilizer used to grow corn is warming the planet and contaminating water. As nitrogen breaks down in the soil, it releases nitrous oxide, a greenhouse gas nearly 300 times more potent than carbon dioxide, the primary driver of climate change that's warming the planet. Since 2000, corn production has surged 50%, adding to its impact on climate change. In 2005, Congress created the Renewable Fuel Standard, which requires that a certain amount of corn-based ethanol be blended into U.S. gasoline annually. More recently, biofuel lobbyists have been pressuring Congress to support ethanol-based jet fuel, which would require 20% more corn acreage. This land use shift would increase food prices and worsen hunger, while boosting nitrogen fertilizer use that will drive up greenhouse gas emissions. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
As U.S. President Donald Trump and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's war in Iran entered a third week, the conflict continues to kill civilians in Iran's leaders, with multiple cities attacked by both sides. While 13 U.S. servicemen and women have died, with some 200 wounded, 1,800 Iranians have been killed, including 165 girls at an elementary school, 10,000 wounded, and 3.2 million displaced. Israeli attacks on Lebanon have killed more than 900. In the Gulf nations, Iranian missile and drone strikes have killed more than 35. 15 Israelis have reportedly been killed thus far, with over 3,000 injured. With its military mostly destroyed, Iran is engaging in asymmetrical warfare by attacking the region's U.S. military bases and neighboring Gulf states' oil infrastructure. Iran has also shut down the critical Strait of Hormuz, where 20% of the world's daily oil supply transits, causing oil and gas prices to increase over 40%. The 27-nation European Union, that includes some of America's closest allies, have rejected President Trump's call to assist the U.S. in reopening the Strait of Hormuz. Donald Trump launched this war against Iran with no clear rationale, inadequate preparation, and no discernible exit plan. Your reporter spoke with Mel Goodman, a senior fellow at the Center for International Policy, a professor of government at Johns Hopkins University, and a former CIA analyst. Here he assesses the motivation, conduct, and consequences of Donald Trump's lawless and chaotic war on Iran.
Iran has made it clear that they're not going to bow to the military power of the United States. They're taking a terrible beating. They have no air defense. They have no air force. They have no way of stopping what we can inflict on them from the air. But there's no sign that they're willing to cave in to us. And even though the regime remains, I think, very unpopular with the majority of the people, once you start bombing these people and they're afraid to come out of their houses, it makes it ludicrous to say that we've done the damage that we need to do. It's up to the people of Iran to leave their homes and seize the government. Well, that is just totally obtuse on his part. So now we're stuck with this mess. And finally, Trump, who told the allies in the beginning, I don't need you. We have the best military in the world. Forget that we've lost wars in Vietnam, Iraq, and Afghanistan over the last 50 years. But anyway, with his best military in the world, he thought he could get this done in a few days, just as Putin thought he could march into Kyiv in 2022 and get the surrender of Zelensky and occupy all of Ukraine. So once again, we're reminded by Karl von Clausewitz that once you start a war, you enter the regime of uncertainty. That's essentially where we are now, a terribly uncertain situation that's getting worse, that's starting to have a huge impact on the American domestic economy. So where this is headed, no one really knows.
Mel, under international law, this war in Iran is illegal. It's a war of aggression, a war of choice, not of necessity. And we have Defense Secretary, or he likes to call himself
Secretary of War Pete Hegseth, constant sloganeering about no rules of engagement, lethality over legality, and most recently, the declaration of no quarter, no mercy for our enemies, a policy viewed by the world as a war crime under international law. And early on in the Trump administration, you had all these JAG officers fired because they're supposed to interpret our own domestic and international law in terms of the conduct of warfare. Mel, what's your comment about Pete Hegseth and his rejection of the Geneva Conventions and any kind of rules of engagement for war?
Well, he is just a terrible embarrassment to the United States on every level. He's engaging in jingoism from the platform of the Pentagon and the Department of Defense. It's frightening to hear him. And on the rare occasions when he does come out, he's usually accompanied by the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, General Kane, who speaks in reasonable tones and understands all of the dangers and the risk and the violence associated with war, in which once that first shot is fired, you can throw all of your scenarios and predictions out the window because it's not going to go the way you planned it to go. And that's been true for just about any war I can think of. And it's also true for the time element in war. Wars that we thought were going to be short-lived went on forever. So Hegseth, to me, is engaging in classic jingoism, to use a British expression from the 19th century. This is an incredible embarrassment. He's embarrassing the professional military. He's embarrassing the United States. He's embarrassing U.S. diplomats. But you have to realize when you look around the international community, there aren't a lot of diplomats in place. The last time I looked at the list, I stopped counting when I got up to 18 or 20 countries that had no U.S. ambassador because Trump just hasn't gotten around to that. And that includes about a dozen nations in the Persian Gulf, Middle East, Southern Europe region, where we've now committed a huge number of troops and a huge percentage of our air power and our naval power. We have about 30% of our active U.S. Navy deployed in the Red Sea and the Indian Ocean. We are maligning allies who we need in any struggle to deal with the oil market and the closed Strait of Hormuz. There's no sign of diplomacy, no sign of consideration to return to the disarmament table. Putin himself has been willing to extend the New START agreement, which expired last month. We didn't give him an answer. So Hegseth is totally out of step with any way of conducting a policy that's needed at times of a crisis. And we don't see anyone willing to silence him. Trump likes all of that bellicose language. He uses it himself. It's infuriating.
That was Mel Goodman, a senior fellow at the Center for International Policy, a former CIA analyst, and national security columnist with Counterpunch.org. Find links to Goodman's recent commentaries on the Iran war and related analysis by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Just days after the U.S. and Israel launched their war against Iran, Trump regime Secretary of State Marco Rubio and Republican House Speaker Mike Johnson stated that the U.S. decision to wage war against the Islamic Republic came after administration officials were informed of an imminent unilateral Israeli attack, suggesting that Trump acted to protect American forces from expected Iranian retaliation. President Trump's charge that Iran was only days away from possessing a nuclear weapon that could destroy Israel is considered not credible by many nuclear experts and is in direct conflict with some U.S. intelligence assessments. For 40 years, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has made regime change in Iran the focus of his political career. Now, with Trump joining him in attacking Iran, Netanyahu may be on the verge of partially or fully realizing his goal. On the 18th day of the war, Joe Kent, director of the Trump administration's National Counterterrorism Center and a longtime MAGA white nationalist extremist, resigned his post by writing a letter to Trump in which he declared, quote, Iran posed no imminent threat to our nation, and it's clear that we started this war due to pressure from Israel and its powerful American lobby. Your reporter spoke with Jacobin Magazine staff writer Branko Marcetic, who examines Israel's role in fomenting this disastrous and deadly U.S. war against Iran.
The President of the United States is the most powerful office in the world. It is certainly the more powerful out of the two governments of Israel and the United States. Israel is completely dependent on the United States to fight its wars for its military defense and so on. So Trump had leverage. Trump could have said no. But what we have seen in recent years, we saw this with Biden as well, when you do not have a strong leader who is able to resist the pressure that Israeli prime ministers and the Israeli state is able to bring to bear on both the President of the United States as well as Congress and the entire U.S. political system, what we see is that the U.S. Unfortunately can be pushed into a war that it does not want, that does not serve anyone's interests in this country. You know, even though Trump could have said no, what we have seen from these public statements that you mentioned and from some of the reporting in places like the Washington Post, the New York Times, is that, you know, Israel may not have been the be-all and end-all of what led to this war, but it certainly played a very large and central role into pushing Trump to launch this war, including, apparently, you know, again, according to several different sources, the Israeli prime minister threatened to basically go to war with Iran by himself without U.S. support, knowing that, you know, Iran planned, if it was attacked again, to hit back not just against Israel but against the United States, thereby pulling the United States into the war, even if it didn't end up doing it. And that's sort of the, you know, according to all these different figures around Trump and some of this reporting, that's sort of part of the way that Netanyahu convinced Trump that he had to do this. And, you know, the point I make in that article, and I think the point that people in the United States really need to think about is, you know, the U.S. gives billions of dollars of military aid to Israel. It gives it the ability to fight all these wars. But what it turns out, I mean, all of this reporting is correct. And what it is also doing by giving Israel this military aid is it's giving Israel effectively the mechanism by which it can draw and pull the United States into conflicts in the Middle East that the American public doesn't want, that American politicians don't even want to be part of, that the American presidents don't want to be part of. That is a very serious and alarming thing.
With the genocide in Gaza and widespread and growing disillusionment with the conduct of Israel, both in Gaza and these regional wars, one after the other, as well as the treatment of the Palestinians in the West Bank, you have evolving public opinion in the United States that is turning decidedly against the close U.S. alignment with Israel. Your response, Branko, to that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think if you look at any polling over the last 2 years, it's a trend that is, you know, across different polling companies, it's across party lines, it's across ideological lines. We clearly see that Israel and the way that it's perceived in the United States has taken tremendous damage. For all the reasons that you and I have discussed on this call, the horrendous crimes against humanity that the country did with U.S. assistance and with U.S. arms over the course of the genocide in Gaza. And now because, you know, I think a lot of people are looking at what is happening in Iran. They're looking at 13 U.S. service members who were killed so far, the hundreds who have been seriously injured, the damage that's being taken to U.S. assets in the region, and then also, you know, the way that prices are going up. And they're saying, we didn't ask for any of this. None of this serves us. We don't want a war with Iran. We actually voted for this guy because we thought he was going to keep us out of this war. And they're seeing, you know, based on these public statements, not just, you know, Rubio and Tom Cotton and Mike Johnson, as you mentioned, but also Trump himself, who has several times in public basically said, well, you know, the reason we're at war is they were going to attack Israel and we have to defend Israel. Now, I think people are starting to think, well, hold on. You know, if we have a security partnership with a country, the idea is that this is meant to be mutually beneficial. Our security is meant to be enhanced. Their security is meant to be enhanced. But what's happening is that the Israeli partnership is increasingly one-sided. It only really serves Israel's security and is actually undermining U.S. security, which would not have lost all these lives and taken all this damage and you know, be embroiled in the economic crisis that's coming if it were not for the fact that Israel was determined to start this conflict with Iran.
That was Branko Marcetic, a Jacobin staff writer and author of Yesterday's Man, The Case Against Joe Biden. Find a link to his recent commentary, U.S. Military Aid to Israel is a National Security Risk, and related analysis by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. There are now more than 400 visibility brigades active across the U.S. in 48 states. These are groups of people who take large banners and hold them on bridges over highways, promoting democracy while criticizing various actions of the Trump administration. All these groups have operated with no legal threat, except for the Connecticut Visibility Brigade, which was founded in the New Haven area just as Trump took office for the second time on January 20th last year. Catherine Hines, the leader of the Connecticut Brigade, was arrested twice in 2025 by the same state trooper, who insisted that what her group was doing was illegal. She was charged both criminally and civilly. Hines' criminal charges were later dismissed, and the ACLU of Connecticut represented her in the civil case, which resulted in a victory for free speech and a clarification of the state regulation defining highway distraction violations. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Hines, who describes how the judge brought both sides together for a mutually agreeable outcome and protection of First Amendment speech and protest.
We have been doing this for more than a year now, and the very first time we went up, which was Valentine's Day 2025, we had a state trooper come up and tell us we couldn't do it. So everything that happened last year, you know, we kept going up on the bridges, deciding not to obey in advance, and it caught up with us. I got arrested twice on the same criminal charges, and then the ACLU, who I had been looking to for advice all along about our civil rights being abridged, moved in and filed a suit against the state, asking them basically to leave us alone because what we were doing was not illegal. You know, we talk about it being a new form of media because it's authentic, it's hyperlocal, it's issues oriented, it's informative, it's you see who's behind the messaging. You know, so often now with you know, disinformation and misinformation, we have to like try to track down sources, like who's telling me this? And in our case, we're personal. We are able to kind of scramble to get up a message that's extremely current. It's taken off for that reason. People are tired of social media and people attacking other people anonymously. And it's created, I think, a sense of societal divisiveness that being on a bridge is very direct and immediate. And we have people coming up and saying, what are you talking about? I don't agree with you. And so we're able to sort of engage with people. It's both sides of the road, as it were. You know, we get our message out to everybody, whether they like it or not. And then we track what we call signs of engagement so that we know who's liking the message and who's not. And it's about, I'd say it's 90-10 that we're getting positive feedback and 10% negative with people flipping us off or, you know, yelling, get a job or whatever.
Tell me about the legal case. I mean, and I wanted to know how precedent setting it was, if it was.
You know, we didn't really want to break the law. We wanted to color within the lines, but we also wanted to make sure that we weren't being, you know, pushed down because of what our messaging is. And so we kept pushing it until the point that I got arrested on criminal charges. And this was a great education for me because I went back to the ACLU and said, okay, I got arrested. What now? And they said, well, unfortunately, you know, these are criminal charges and we're civil rights attorneys. So we can't help you with that. So I had to go out and find a criminal lawyer to defend me in the first two hearings that we had in court. The second time I got arrested, it was because the trooper self-dispatched. He wrote himself a warrant for my arrest and took it to a judge and got it signed and came to my house at 6 a.m. And that was, you know, out of bounds that people kind of sat up and started paying notice. It was pretty scary and pretty much textbook fascist move. I hate to say that, but, you know, grabbed me basically out of my pajamas and put me in a handcuffed me and put me in a car and drove me to Bridgeport. So criminal charges in both cases were dropped. And then the ACLU was preparing this civil rights case and that was asking for a temporary injunction against the troopers. And they, you know, they gathered a lot of evidence, the troopers' video cameras that they wear, showing all the interactions and all the ways that we had tried to color within the lines, how polite we were, et cetera. I mean, and none of that stuff matters. You know, it was really just us being told we couldn't do something that was happening in every other state at this point, except for West Virginia, Missouri, and all around Connecticut. It was just us. So the hearing, we had two plaintiffs who had to stay off the bridges for 6 months while this whole thing, you know, lurched along through the judicial system. And they were deposed by the state. And their case was they were feeling intimidated by the troopers because being, you know, the way we've been harassed on five separate occasions. And so they were asking, you know, to be left alone. You know, we had really done a lot of due diligence in this way. We had a traffic safety expert in our crew who had helped edit the state regulations on what constitutes distractions and what's allowed on bridges. So after a couple of hours of back and forthing, both sides agreed on new language that would go out to the troopers as a special order, basically saying what these protesters are doing on overpasses very specifically is legal. And as long as they're not doing, if they're standing in the roadway, attaching things to the fences, you know, in a permanent fashion, et cetera, then, you know, they need to be allowed to do this. After the hearing was adjourned, the judge, and people were just sort of milling around, the judge came down and said to the protesters, he said, "I just want to thank you for what you're doing. You know, it's really important that people stand up."
That was Catherine Hines, leader of the Connecticut Visibility Brigade. Her group and others across the U.S. will be promoting and participating in the No King's Day national protest on Saturday, March 28th. Learn more about the Visibility Brigades by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Whale Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Blue Sky at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WESU in Middletown, Connecticut, WEFT in Champaign, Illinois, KBCS in Bellevue, Washington, dozens of other community radio stations across the U.S. and abroad, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.